This is Open Mic Live. Let's go! Welcome to this week's episode. We have a very special guest coming. Welcome back to Open Mic Live. For the first interview of the regular season, I had the incredible opportunity to travel to Vienna and sit down with Andrea Jungmann, a name synonymous with Sotheby's. Andrea has been with the renowned auction house since 1989 and was appointed managing director of Sotheby's Austria, Hungary, and Poland in 2001. Her impressive career includes landmark sales like Paul Rubens' The Massacre of the Innocents in 2002, and the record-breaking auction of Gustav Klimt's Litzelbach am Attersee for $40.4 million in 2011 in New York, making it the second most expensive Klimt landscape ever sold. Andrea has also played a pivotal role in the sales of important restituted works by Klimt in Chile. When you Google her name, it's almost as if Sotheby's could be her second last name. I first watched her in action during a charity auction last year, and after a few emails, she graciously accepted my invitation to join me on Open Mic Live. She welcomed me on a Friday evening at the stunning Sotheby's offices housed in a historic palace in the heart of Vienna. If all of this sounds magical, just wait until you hear our conversation. We dive into her role as a pillar of the auction world, the responsibility of making art visible and accessible, and the evolving luxury buyer. A quick note, any slight sound discrepancies you might hear may be thanks to the palace's incredible acoustic, so please bear with us. For all this and more, enjoy the episode. Andrea, welcome to Open Mic Live. Thank you so much for being here. Really, it's an honor to have you on the podcast. In this season of Open Mic Live, the focus is even more on the person behind the name and behind the profession. So let's start by you introducing yourself. And please tell me, who are you? What is your passion? What is your profession?
Okay, my profession is easy. I'm the managing director of Sotheby's Austria, Hungary, and Poland. And I'm also senior director at Sotheby's. I'm more or less an expert in the art market, as I'm in the art market for more than 30 years. I studied history of art. The art is part of my life. Couldn't be without it, I would say. When I finished school, I wanted to become an artist. That was the aim. I very quickly found out that I'm not going to be an artist all my life. I'm not good enough, and I'm not, which is good because you should know that if you can, if that's the only thing you want to do. I think that's something. Knowing a lot of artists, I know that an artist has an urge to produce art, to be creative, continuously, always, ever, blah blah blah, and I. Just fortunately found out when I was 19 that that's not me. So I also want to do a lot of things, but that's the thing. I want to do a lot of things.
You already had a critical eye on your work.
And then I wanted to deal with people, and I was creative, but I wasn't creative enough anyway. But I loved art. So I studied history of art and cultural management. And then somehow during my studies, I landed at Sotheby's, and here I am, still here, a dinosaur, and still loving it, yeah.
What does your day-to-day life look like right now, where you are?
Right now?
Exactly.
This is very funny.
And I know we had to reschedule because you had an exam.
Because I'm going to be a certified and court expert for art. Yeah, the last few days I learned a lot. But otherwise, my day-to-day work, there is no day the same as the other one. You have to be very flexible. The main thing, if I would describe it, is communicating with people about their art or art they want to buy. So that's one part, and that comprises a lot of things. Mm-hmm. It's like just very like short communication. Someone asks, what is my painting worth? And then you just go back and say, oh, whatever, we don't want it for a sale, or we want it. And then the complicated things, yeah, where you have to do a lot of talking and negotiating a contract and organizing the transport and things like this. So, but I think communication, looking at art, finding new ways of getting business in, that's one thing. And the other thing is also very a social component, going out to receptions, dinners, fairs, exhibitions, and also always looking at art, so you have to stay on top, somehow, which is getting more and more difficult, because there's so much, even in Vienna. This is a small town, also this is a big city, but it's smaller than New York or London, so it's probably should be easier, but it's still quite a lot. That sounds now all very, there's also a lot, a big pile of administration. I don't have an assistant. I had assistants, but I'm still of that kind of person. I like to do my own appointments. I like to, I'm quite good in organization, doing logistic things, so that's okay. I like to do it. I think that the essence of the work I do and should do is bringing in business or selling works of art. Yeah, so that's, and I like to do that. I like the communication with people.
I would like to shed light on you as an art collector. In an interview that you gave, you described your own approach to collecting as brave. Can you elaborate a bit on that?
It's not brave. When I do my, I also give talks, and when I, on artist investment. So when I do that, I'm always asked, so how do I start to collect art? And I said, start with young art, that's not expensive, but it's risky. So that's what you maybe mean with brave. For a very long time, I didn't call myself a collector. And I still think I'm not a collector, really. If I buy art, it's not expensive. Nearly all of the time I know the artist personally, and I just fall in love with that piece or the work, or the whole work, and then I want to have one. So meanwhile, it's a mess, and suddenly I don't have enough walls.
I believe that's what you said, that this is when you're a collector, when you don't have enough space.
And then I thought, like, so maybe I am a collector. Each work I have, and some of them are still in piles and not framed and not on the wall, has a story. So, and that's what I like, And it might, it has nothing to do with investment for me. For me, it's, I like to have them around me on the wall and not getting bored of it. That's what I sometimes say, you must just love it, and it must have a connection to you and give you more and not getting bored. So that's, and I still, I have some things I have now for 20 years and I still love them. I look at them and I say, oh, I'm so happy to have this in my home.
It's what builds your home and what exactly makes it a home, not a house.
So that's what I do, and I also love. I have this program in our office. We have this program called Artist Quarterly, so four artists a year, and so and I select them. Mm-hmm. So I select the artist myself, and that's always starts more or less with a studio visit and a long talk, or a not so long talk, whatever. And this I like really a lot, because it opens up new worlds. Each time it's a new world, Or if I meet an artist and I can talk to him and he can explain to me why he does what he does, for someone who's like in the business, in the art selling and buying business, that's something for me is very special and very important. And so that's why I do the the program.
I have a few questions on this program to you because, if I'm not mistaken, you started it in 2001. Can you tell me what moved you to do this? How did you decide to do that?
Yeah, it's very interesting because we are now in the second floor, which was the original office. So your listener cannot see, but it's a more or less a normal office. And we just had the exhibitions in the office, yeah? And then in 2007, I think, we got the first floor, which is an exhibition space. And that was wonderful. So, okay, what made me do this was already before we moved here, we had another office in the city. Already there did, I think, one show with young artists just because we had the space and so on. And then knowing a lot of artists, and in 2000, there were, I think, half of the galleries we have now. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So artists, young artists, didn't have space to exhibit. There were no off spaces, no Kunsthallen, you know, things like this, nothing. Yeah. And they complained. They said, you know, no gallery, they don't want me, I applied with everyone, they don't want me, and there's no space, and I need to show. And I said, yeah, you need to show. Mm-hmm. And then I thought, you know what, I have this space, yeah, why not just use it and make it the easiest way possible, only 4 exhibitions a year, mm-hmm. things which, you know, you can put somewhere and they are not disturbing the day-to-day work of whatever, yeah? And so that's how it started, yeah. And it was very quiet in the beginning. Yeah? I mean, we printed like a letter invitation. Yeah, mm-hmm. There was no real opening. Yeah, there was no press, nothing. Yeah, mm-hmm. we even forgot to take photographs. Yeah, so it's like it was just like just doing it. Yeah, and so and now it grows and now it's a well-known project and it's fun.
Mentoring is a very big aspect of the podcast. I, for example, I grew up in a home full of art. My grandparents had also a home like this. The first time when I went somewhere where there was no art, I thought maybe they had painting the walls recently. Something like this. So I think it really starts from where you come from, how you were raised. But if not, you can still develop a passion for it. So I think that giving the space for artists to show their work, making art more approachable, mm-hmm. It's also part of it.
That's something which is very important for me. I think, mentoring. So I like to support people. Yeah, and I mean, I could not do it if it would be a real expensive thing. Yeah, mm-hmm. that they would not probably accept it. But we started very, you know, low-key, and it's still more or less low-key, but it has a professional image now. I loved it, and they were all happy. I mean, if you look at the list of artists I had, yeah, and then a lot of them are... I mean, for example, Anna Jamelaeva, who is now representing Austria at the Biennale in Venice, she was one of the first I showed, because I knew her.
Yeah.
So it's really nice, yeah.
And it makes me think about what you said before, that a big part of your work is communicating with people, having this in your day-to-day life. And I mean, even if you started low-key, for Sotheby's to exhibit your work is amazing as a young artist. And I cannot even imagine how it feels, probably how it feels to me that you're now on the podcast. So I'm very, very happy about that. And just to go a little bit back about your collecting art, can you tell us maybe about the last piece you got?
I have to think if that was the last piece. I think it was by Edin Zenun, who we showed last year. Mm-hmm. It's a tiny oil painting, and I just loved it.
What made you decide to get it?
The size, no. That's a joke. But the size is very small, so there is space in my home. No. I love the work of Edin Zenun, and I like that the paintings are very small and very concentrated. The ideas he has and how he paints. I mean, he paints so every little has a, you know, it has to be. It takes a long time for him to paint these things. Then I wanted to show him, and then there was this one which I fell in love with.
The one
that's It could have been another one, but it was that one.
That one. Yeah.
Yeah, that one. Yeah, and so I think that's what I did. Right. But that's how it happens.
Yeah.
Yeah. I walk by another time, and then I think like, oh shit, I really need this.
My first experience with auctioning was when I met you at this auction, and actually, what I tried to do there was to acquire my first painting, unsuccessfully, unfortunately. But I was lucky because I got introduced to the art and world of auctioning by seeing you in this auction, and then I decided to do everything possible to get you on the podcast so that I can talk to you personally. So at the end of the day, it was a successful night for me.
That's very good. That's fun.
Yes, it's great. And I think that, especially talking to you now, there is a specific way you talk when you auction. You get into auctioning mood.
That's true. Yeah. I always say I'm on the stage. Yeah. I'm now on the stage, and then now we, and I love it. Yeah. So maybe I should have become an actor or something, or I don't know, sometimes. I really like it.
So notoriously, you were responsible for the sale of Massacre of Innocent by Rubens in 2001 for £49.5 million.
Yes.
And you have significant contributions for the auction sales of at least 4 Klimt works of art.
Maybe, yeah. They're all on the chimney over there. 1, 2, 3. Yeah. 4 maybe, yes. And 2 Schillers.
And 2 Schillers, exactly. And one was a world record, if I'm not mistaken, for
yes,
a Klimt landscape.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Talking about this, what does it feel like to be part of the path of a lifetime of an art piece like this?
Wonderful. And as you might know, because I see you did your research, most of them are restituted pieces. Yeah. So each of them... It's funny, I have this similarity to my Artist Quarterly program. Anyway, so each one of them has a story with me. Yeah? So it is not... now we have to cut.
We had to pause for a moment because a client came in to collect their newly acquired masterpiece, an exciting moment in the world of art that I was very happy to witness. While we take a quick break, here is a reminder that you can catch every episode of Open Mic Life a day early on RTL Play. Be sure to subscribe, and if you're enjoying the show, please leave a review. It really helps. Now back to the episode.
They have a story with me because a restituted art piece, usually it takes years from the first, I don't know, where you discover it or where you meet the client or whatever, till it's sold. Yeah, and this is a long way of research, meeting the people, getting to know them, negotiation, lots of trust. Yeah, there has to be trust, otherwise it doesn't work at all. Yeah, and long negotiations, and then the sale, mm-hmm. and then big happiness most of the time. and that means again, it's the same thing again, the communication. If I look at it, because they're standing there, the listener doesn't see, but the photographs of all these pictures are here. And when I look at them, there are people involved with each of these pictures. People who I still am in touch with. Mm. Yeah. So not only Christmas or so, but if we are in the same place, we go and have dinner or lunch, and then it's lots of talk, 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 and it has nothing to do anymore with picture. Yeah, it's about life and family, and that's very special, very special.
As you say it, you know, now you're still friends, and it's what connected you. And in this way, the painting and the art of work becomes part of your life, like you become part of its life. So it's really an amazing cycle. How do you prepare for an auction of a piece of history?
You mean prepare for selling something? I mean, because it's another thing. Yeah, that's the negotiation part, mm-hmm. getting the thing in. And then there is the auction, which someone else does. Yes. So I'm just watching, yeah, and hoping, or maybe sometimes I have a buyer as well. If we take these restitution things, I mean, there's a lot of research just at the beginning. Yeah, it's the research is the oeuvre catalogue of the artist, and then you need to know which are the names which are dangerous from like the World War II period, yeah? So you know that, yeah? You know, as a dangerous, you have the victims and you have the people who took the things away, or, and you know the names. You should know them. Funny enough, there's still names popping up now, 100 years later nearly, yeah? And you know that, and then you look at the work catalog, you find a name, you think, that sounds not good. Yeah. So you start to research, you go into archives, you go, which I don't do myself, more or less, so I usually we have a researcher. And then my part is then to call the owner and say, oh, I'm so sorry to tell you, but there is something wrong with the provenance of your picture. So what we can help, yeah? So that's one part, yeah, which in most of the things we had it, or we had we were in touch with the heirs, so the ones, the heirs of the victims, and then found out where is the picture. But it's a lot of research, so that's the beginning. And then starts a long process of getting the two parties together, getting a deal somehow done. Then there is the auction, and the auction is a totally different thing because that's either in London, New York, or wherever. And then there is the exhibition before. So then usually I take the family around, or I take the client around, or whatever. And then there is the evening, the big evening thing, the sale, and that's very. I mean. Especially the evening sales are very exciting. Yeah, you're like full of, especially if you have something like the Rubens, yeah, or one of these Klimts, you're so excited. Yeah, so me, it's not my picture, and it has in fact nothing to do with me. Yeah, but you can see the family or the client sitting in there, and you just wish, please make it sell, please make it sell, please make it sell for a good price. And then it goes up, and usually at that price level, it goes very slow. Yeah, so you sit there and you think like, one more bid, please, one more bid. Yeah, and then usually it goes well. But I also had experiences where it didn't go well. But most of the time it goes well because these are sensational pieces. Yeah, and it can take a long time, and then it's celebration after the sale. Yeah, so you go and have a good dinner and drinks and things like this, and it's. The great thing at the auction is it is like an event, a stage event, but on the other hand it's the peak of all you did the combination, and then also everyone's then happy. Usually not always, but usually and that's really nice.
Do you remember a specific moment in an auction when you were truly surprised of something that happened or something that didn't happen? Something where you were like, this I didn't expect.
I didn't expect the Rubens going up that high. Yeah, I mean, there were bets before, yeah, because apparently the old master experts knew a little bit that this is really important. Yeah, but I mean, the estimate was 2 to 3 million. Yeah, I mean, nothing. Yeah, and then there were the bets, and some said, oh, it's going to make 15 or maybe 20, but 49.5, I mean, it's like really, really big. Yeah, so that was a big surprise. And it happens, and then it's very nice.
You need
at least two really, really, really eager buyers with a lot of money. So, two. Better more. You need a good evening, you need good weather, yeah, so that people want to go out and want to go to an auction. You also need the good timing, in the sense of they have to be confident to spend money. Yeah, they have to be happy. So if you have crisis in the world, you can feel it in the sale room.
That makes sense. And it's also because art, buying art, selling art, but mostly if you want to spend a lot of money, you have to have a pleasure out of it. Yeah. So, of course, you're selling something. And you, as you said, you're a seller in this moment. Mm-hmm. But you have to somehow make it a wonderful, pleasurable experience.
Yeah. That's exactly what we try to do. Yeah, you can't always promise, but and there is always this risk. An auction is always risk.
Have you had a moment where you knew a piece or you knew the artist and you know the buyer and you're like, I don't want this buyer to get this piece?
Not going to talk about that.
Okay. See, I was wondering if I can find
I'm
something.
Not going to talk about it.
Very good. how do you see the profile of the buyer changing? Because I'm sure that it depends what new buyers come into the space. Do you see a new wave coming? Do you see the profile
changing? So there is, of course, right now we are in a... It's changing insofar that the boomer generation is getting older and probably is trying to, might in the next 10 years start to sell things or give it to their kids, but the kids might not be interested. Mm-hmm. That's what you can see. Yeah, they're interested in different things. New buyers or the main buyers are, they're around 40, 50. Of course, they go for different things. Yeah, so, I mean, if they have a lot of money, they still buy Picasso and, you know, the things. But they, contemporary art is very much, and design and photographs, but also handbags and wine and cars. Yeah, so we have this mix here, which the boomers, they're not interested in. Of course, they have cars, but they would not probably pay so much for a handbag. But anyway, so there is a little change, there will be a change, then, and that means also that there is probably also the volume of the market, so things coming up. I mean, there will be now coming up probably a few collections, so like it was the Paul Allen or the Landau collection. So that's always good and coming up and bringing stuff in. But I think that we'll see. I mean, there are so many billionaires in the world, never that many before. So they are buying in the top, of course, a big turnover for the auction houses. Okay. But the many people, these are the younger ones, and they don't pay millions for an artwork. Yeah. But what was very interesting... In 2020, when we started the whole, the online sales got really like big, for the but fortunately it worked. Yeah, it worked very well, and we had so many new buyers.
Really?
Yeah, in the following 2 years, that has now, since the live auctions are back again, not as much as before, but they are, and people can travel and go to fairs and so on. It has changed. So they're still there, but they don't buy that. I think people were just sitting in front of their PC or whatever, laptop, and they just bought art, which is also a good thing, because, I mean, 20 years ago, we tried to do the internet online sales, and no one was interested. I'm not going to buy art through it.
Yeah, where is the glamour in buying art from home?
Yeah, and also, I don't trust
it, and who knows, I haven't seen it. Yeah. I mean, nowadays, if you look at it, people, they just buy art for millions online, and I'm like, ooh, that's interesting, but it's good, but it's also because the trust is there, apparently, so the trust is there, and that's good.
And certainly the trust is also associated with the institution that you work for. And I want to talk a little bit about that, so let's talk a bit about Sotheby's. It's an institution that is shaping the world, the vision of art, in a way, and you have worked there for over 2 decades, and you have also built your expertise there. So there's two specific aspects of that I'm quite curious about. Firstly, to what extent do you consider yourself as part of Sotheby's?
I am Sotheby's. It's really...
I don't even have to ask the second part of the question, because what part is Sotheby's of your identity?
Now, it's a big part, but... I know that I have a position at Sotheby's, which makes me, in the eyes of other people, very important. Yeah, so they treat me as an important person. But I know that the moment that Sotheby's hat goes off, and it will be at some point, because I'm getting older, and then it's natural, I'm probably not that important anymore. So I know very well that there is the Andrea Jungmann, and then there is the Sotheby's Andrea Jungmann. And I'm very happy that the Andrea Jungmann is also quite interesting.
Very interesting. Of course I do. And I think to have such a sober perspective of the difference of both is very important, especially when, as you said, you are Sotheby's right now. You are the managing director of Austria-Hungary in Poland. So that's also triad. I want to talk about like why exactly this, but have you ever thought about becoming independent at some point in the way?
I have thought about a lot of things in all these years, yeah? Doing that, changing, blah, blah. No, I haven't. Mm-hmm. Because, as we just said, it's much easier with the name in the background. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's one thing. And the other thing is also that the job at Sotheby's has certain characteristics which you only find in an auction house. If you are independent, you can do these things as well, but you will do it in a different way or not at all. And so whenever I try to find out if that way is nice or that way or whatever, I made like plus and minus, and then I was like, okay, no, thank you. I don't get what I want. I said, what I have now, yeah? So that's why I'm still here.
It's a very, again, very sober way of looking at it. And that's great. Very nice. Can you tell me a bit about why exactly Austria, Hungary and Poland?
Just a traditional thing, yeah? Yeah, yeah, it was when I started in the 90s, yeah, already there were no offices in at that time, Czechoslovakia, mm-hmm, and Hungary. Hungary, yes, Hungary had a little office, but they were reporting to Austria. Okay. Yeah, so as Austria reports to Germany, so we are, I can do what I want, but yeah, that's my reporting line. Yeah, and so they report to me. So when I took over in 2000, there was only Hungary, mm-hmm, at that time. Czech Republic, I had Czech, mm-hmm, then Czech already, Czech Republic as a Prague. I had also under my wings, yeah, but the person there who did it already for about 10 years or so, I said, you know what, they don't need my wings, yeah? Okay. So he doesn't need my wings, and it's also, just do it yourself, yeah? And if you have questions, then call me, yeah? But I don't need it under my control, yeah, anymore. So I only had Hungary. Mm-hmm. And then a few years ago, when Polish contemporary art got more and more interesting, and so then I got Poland as well. Okay. We had a representative. We'll see. Now we do it from London and from here. But there's not much you do. Yeah, mm-hmm. These are both countries where very strict export laws. So, but it's good to be there.
And of course, Austria and Hungary have a very, very long relationship.
The K&K office, you know, Kaiser Königlich, you know, traditional Habsburg.
To finish the topic, I know that a big part of the business is selling heirloom pieces and supporting families in making these decisions. Has there been a time where you advise somebody, don't sell, keep this?
Not if it's worth much. But I mean, yeah, it's always the decision of the seller. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I always say, you don't need to sell, but it would be good. Yeah. Yeah. I only say not to sell if it's not much worth. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And someone wants to sell and I say, that makes no sense. You have to send it to New York. Transport costs is like, that's the only time. But mm-hmm. But I do understand if someone, I'm not the person who pushes someone. Yeah. Yeah? So, but I better say, I understand if you don't want to sell. Yeah. It's okay. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and I had clients, I have quite a few clients who just said, I don't want to sell now. Mm-hmm. I want to keep it. And then maybe if I'm older or I don't know, my kids want to sell or whatever. Yeah. So,
how do you see the auctioning industry developing and changing? We talked a bit about the internet part of it and how the buyer is changing technology-wise or mood of buyers. What do you see happening in the auctioning industry?
Okay, so we will not know what's going to happen, yeah, so I'm going to say, but I think what you can see already is that the new technologies are in the business, yeah? Yeah. We do so many online sales. I mean, that's the main thing, yeah? I mean, we have the evening sales and, of course, there are the high-value lots, so the high-value works of art, but we don't print catalogs anymore, yeah? So that's all online. All is online. Social media, we are very big on social media. Yeah, we have, I think, 5 million followers or something like that. Probably already now 6, yeah, I don't know. We do, exactly, we do everything, so Insta and TikTok and... there is an addition, which has changed in the last 2-3 years is that the luxury market has grown incredibly. Luxury is not only jewelry and watches, we know that that was always there, but it's that grew a lot, but also cars, wine, handbags, sneakers, you know, all these things. So that's something I think which will still grow a lot. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that means that the art kind of thing, yeah, which we are an art auction house, so that's going to be differently balanced, I would say. We'll see, yeah. So that's one thing. Then that what we also do since a few years, more than the luxury part, is the private sales. So we are really in competition with every dealer, every gallerist, because we do private sales without auction. That just goes under the radar, or not so much under the radar, but whatever. We have galleries all around the world where we do private exhibitions. We do exhibitions, and that's for private sale, for direct sale. So not, I think the dealers don't like us very much about that. But anyway, that's what it is. So that's one thing. Regarding buyers, I already said that I think that there is a shift coming up, but also we don't know what's going to happen. We know that the Asian market is extremely strong. Yeah, there are lots of buyers from there. But also Brazil or US will always be the thing. We will see what happens to UK, because with Brexit, you could see a little shift to Paris. It all depends on regulations, new regulations, wars or not wars, at the elections this year. We don't know what's going to happen. So, and that all influences the art market, yeah? I mean, it says that, it says on our website, I think, that the place where collectors go or something like that, yeah? And I think that's the idea, yeah? So that a collector can go on our website and find everything he needs. Information, it's a lot of information on there, yeah? Like videos on works of art and explanations. And so I think... And I know that clients want to have everything, you know, they just call one person and then everything's done, yeah? I can't do everything. Well, that's what they expect, but it's not always the case, yeah.
You touched briefly upon wars. When I was preparing for the interview, I found a picture of how they're unpacking the Mona Lisa after the Second World War. Mm-hmm. Of course, in turbulent times like this, when conflicts happen, the humanitarian aspect takes precedent, as it should. But what about the works of art? How do people save these things? What goes on in people's minds?
I think there were, just read it in the news, from Odessa. I think pictures from Odessa were moved to Germany, I think, in a museum, because just to make sure that nothing happens to them. So I think that's probably what should happen. Yeah, but you are right. I think that's the second or third or fourth or fifth thought you have. Yeah, but a lot of things are destroyed by wars.
And people probably also think to save these things, and later on in the years they're discovered again, have to be restored. So, a lot more work to be done, I'm sure.
Endless. I tell you, it's endless.
Endless work. Do you dream of auctioning a specific art or a piece of art?
You know what? If you are auctioneering, so if I think of that aspect, if I'm auctioneering, I don't even see the art properly. Yeah, it's blur. Yeah, it's other things different, other things important. If I would like to sell a work of art to find, you know, get as a business in. Oh my God, there are so many. Don't ask me that. But it needs to be in private hands. And that's I know of a few things I really would like to.
Can you tell me one?
No.
No?
This is part of my job. Not talk about it.
And my last question, because it's Friday evening and I want to give you back your time. What is next for you personally in your career?
What is next? This is difficult. I go to Venice, to the Biennale, but that's not my career. Honestly, I don't know. I'm open for whatever comes. So I'm not sure if it is at Sotheby's. There is something still new. Yeah, but I could imagine something completely different. It has to do something with art. That's the thing. So let's see. Honestly, I don't have all my life. I didn't have a real plan. I didn't say in 3 years' time this is going to happen or that's where I'm. It just happened because I was there when it happened. So it's going to be there, I'm sure.
Andrea, thank you so much for being part of Open Mic Life. It was really a pleasure and an honor to
thank
have you.
Thank you. No, thank you for coming especially, and it was really nice.
Thank you.
Very
so much.
Delightful.
Thank you for tuning in. See you next week on Open Mic Life.